Welcome to the Banking Reinvented podcast. Every week, we discuss how banks can harness the power of AI to drive remarkable growth. You're listening to Tim Rutten, and I'll be joined by senior executive changemakers from around the globe, unpacking what works and what doesn't. Ready to unlock growth mode together? Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Banking Reinvented, a podcast for changemakers in banking. And this morning, I'm joined by Adrian McPhee, our CTO. Adrian, good morning.
Hello, good morning. Great to be here.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It took ages to get you here in the seat.
Yeah, moved a couple of times.
Yeah, all good. But at least your hair is looking great, so we can we can dive into it.
You'll see.
But maybe to kick things off, tell us a little bit about yourself and the background that you've brought to the table so far.
Yeah, thanks. I would say that I'm more of a builder type CTO, so I like to keep my hands dirty. But I've been in enough enterprise situations that that I know how to, let's say, bring that builder mentality into the enterprise, and also how to bring what an enterprise needs into, let's say, the software development processes and the whole delivery of software into a company, and how to connect engineers with business interests. So I'm sort of able to keep my hands dirty whilst reasoning about the big picture and, you know, thinking about topics like risk management, data management, and things like that natively as well.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit of background. You also spent quite some time at LeasePlan, which I believe had a banking license.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So LeasePlan was the world's biggest leasing company. So we had around 2 million cars in 32 countries at peak. We had a banking license. So we had a retail bank here in the Netherlands. We're regulated by the DNB and then the ECB. And so that was a really interesting mix of private equity on one side and then being regulated on the other side. So having to move fast as well as staying compliant. We built a lot of interesting things there to do with, leasing cars through the internet and the whole, all of the onboarding processes and things associated with that. We also built a used car, a way of, let's say, selling the lease cars to consumers. It was called Car Next. It was shut down.
Yeah.
But yeah, we sold that business to French bank, and then I left when that occurred. So yeah, it was a great journey. I was there for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Now you've been with Backbase now for half a year, give or take.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
And I know for a fact, because over lunch we have these discussions, that you also spend your evening hours still building and hobbying and prototyping on your own, which is very much... It's very AI focused, I would say, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 4 to 6 months before I joined Backbase, I was working on something a little bit connected to what I was doing at LeasePlan. I met up with the guys who started Swapfeets, which is this big bike sharing sort of usership business in the Netherlands. They were working on their new business, which was funnily enough to do with used electric cars. And so I thought this is a fascinating thing to get involved with. It's called Ecasion. I thought, yeah, let me see if I can help them and leverage AI, reason back from, let's say, what are their business processes, how to create an architecture from that, and how to create specifications, and then leverage AI to help build them a really, you know, the system that I think that they should have, and do that on my own in a pretty short period of time. I built them a platform that is handling everything from getting all of the data from the supply channels from different leasing companies and auction sites, all the way through the inventory management, matching vehicles with demand from consumers. And this whole process is completely AI driven in terms of the software development lifecycle, in terms of the way that I even modeled their business processes in a way with AI, using formats that AI could understand. And now, indeed, I'm still I'm a builder, like I said, right? So I keep my hands a little bit dirty, helping them with some stuff here and there on the weekends. And so recently, for example, I built a damage detection capability, which is able to analyze these photographs using AI to find damage. And what's amazing is, you know, if I compare what's possible now versus like even 4 or 5 months ago, there's been huge, huge steps forward. I mean, I remember I tried to build a damage detection service to analyze these photographs earlier this year. And, you know, there was like a ruler on the car showing the damage on the car. And the model I was using at the time, you know, thought that that was damage. So it would say there's a big salmon-colored mark on the car, but that was actually the ruler, right? So it couldn't tell. And now, if I compare the, you know, some of the new models, I'm using some of the ones from OpenAI, actually, the computer vision capabilities have just taken like incredible steps forward. I mean, able to even assess the cost of repairing it. It's still difficult to achieve. And you know, you have to have a very like disciplined approach to the way that you build the software and test it and validate the output and control the LLM. But yeah, huge steps forward. So yeah, I like to keep my hands dirty with that. Yeah, here and there.
Just out of curiosity, what you built there in your spare time, how would you, in the old model, have built it, and how many people would you have needed to get that done?
Yeah, I think you know, it this sounds kind of absurd, but in a company, if you know, probably we would have had 50 people working on this for half a year, conservatively. And I was able to do it myself directly with these two founders who of course understand what they want in, let's say, 4 months. But that's, I mean, I'm able to jump between, you know, discussing their business processes and modeling it and, leveraging LLMs and then sort of doing a loop and coming up with a prototype of an architecture and then evolving it myself. But, you know, if you've got a high level of motivation, you understand the business domain, and you're able to make aggressive use of these tools. Yeah, it's, I mean, this is really would have taken 50 people 6 months to do something equivalent, which is bizarre, but it really sounds absurd to say, but that's my experience from having done similar things before and having done similar things now. Yeah.
It sounds completely insane. That's also why I wanted you to share the story, because it's one of those moments of, okay, please explain us more, or at least show us more how that works.
The thing is, like, what I did was to break the problem up into several bounded contexts and then to be able to leverage AI in these bounded contexts to move in a kind of parallel way. So it's about setting it up. Like, I mean, if you're able to maybe start in greenfield is one thing. And if you have the right architecture and you leverage AI in these contexts that you create, then you're also able to make a lot more speed because you break the problem down and you sort of, you're reasoning from the business. I mean, funnily, one of the guys, Richard, who's one of the founders of this business, told me that I was reverse engineering the system from their business, which I thought was quite funny. So domain-driven design for the win, I think, with AI.
And now you've spent already 6 months with Backbase, and we're super happy to have you on board as a builder CTO type. We have a lot of work to do, especially in basically pushing everything related to AI in the context of banking, of course, in the context of doing it safely and explainable and everything that comes with it. What we're going to do this episode is explore a little bit, what is the high part, what is the real part, and how do you get ready to embrace it? Of course, the example you just shared is very extreme.
Yeah. Right?
One individual that could basically build for 50 people.
Yeah.
It's the 50x amplifier almost. So for this episode, the AI amplifier, that's what we're going to unpack. And maybe we could kick off with the question that, what is separating the hype from the real transformative potential today in the context of banking?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think if you probably remember the song Oops, I Did It Again by Britney Spears.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Great song.
If you think back to that time, that was, I think it was released in May, middle of 2000. Yeah. And the reason I bring this song up is for two reasons. One is to picture ourselves then and think about the internet. And the other one is to make sure that we don't, oops, I did it again, and let's say become Blockbuster or, Nokia or something like that. And I'm using the internet as a kind of parallel for AI, of course, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about hype and we're talking about, you know, transformation. And I think what we tend to think is that it's one or the other, right? So I think in 2000, 2001, we'd had at least 90s hype associated with associated with the internet, and people kind of thought it was a bubble, it had burst. I mean, it was a bubble, it did burst, it was hype, and it was also then set to transform everything over the next, you know, 10 years, basically. So I think that's a key thing, is that something can be hype and it can also be genuinely transformative, right? And then it's for banking in particular, I think it's a matter of then taking a long-term view and then also looking at, okay, what are we going to do this week? So I would say separate out the signal from the noise in the AI claims. So don't get into this thinking that it is hype or it is it is everything. It is genuinely transformative. You have to take a long-term view. You can't get stuck with the hype. And I think investing in fundamentals that you need to have, regardless of the timing of exactly what's going to happen when, is the key. So it's challenging, but, you know, think in decades and act in quarters or something like that is what I would say. I think those are the companies that win. If you think about Amazon, for example, I mean, they tend to focus on things that are, you know, always going to be true, that like customers don't want to pay more than they have to. They want their packages delivered quickly. And then if you think about that in a banking context, of course, you can come up with similar ideas about customer needs, work backwards from that and figure out how you're going to leverage AI and what fundamentals you need to have in your business to be able to exploit that. And so, yeah, don't see it as hype that's meaningless. Don't see it as the answer to every question. Take a long-term view and get moving, would be my advice.
What are you currently seeing in the market? So do you see that clear split between black and white, like it's everything or it's nothing? Because, of course, there's a lot of... The hype cycle is very real, yep. Right? The hype train is going strongly. And, of course, you see announcement after announcement from the big players. You see partnerships happening. There's just a lot of focus on what they are bringing to market. But at the same time, you're saying, yeah, there's also real gravity to how you bring it to life right now.
Yeah.
I just think that's only for the few that understand how to embrace it and bring it home. Versus, I think the majority of the population is still focusing on, okay, what's actually happening? How do we bring it home?
Yeah.
So maybe out of your experience so far, also in just the Backbase context and speaking with our customers, do you see that divide, or do you still feel people are curious to learn and just trying to get their bearings with the concepts?
Yeah, I think everybody knows that there's something here, but they don't fully understand it. And then to me, you end up then in a way, people maybe jump into use cases or something like this, or they maybe jump into creating an AI version of some existing business process. I think that's one of the risks is that, in a way, you have to think from first principles and really understand your customer needs and work backwards. I think that is not necessarily the way that AI is coming into every company. So I think many times, I mean, you have strategy consulting firms contacting you, telling you how you should use AI in a generic way. And then it's probably going to be a layer on top of your business or something.
Yeah.
I think that is a trend where, of course, that is part of the hype cycle. I don't think that's necessarily going to work, because if you don't have the fundamentals in place, if you don't have the right data management infrastructure and talent, if you don't have the right, let's say, risk management approach, you're not going to win. So I think we're kind of in this bit of this consulting phase, and I think you see it also with OpenAI starting their own like consultancy firm. That it's super. There is a barrier between the technology and the company using it in a way. And one of the things I've been thinking about that's quite interesting is, you know, like Microsoft Excel. Right? If we go back to the 90s, we go back to 90. I don't know. Let's go back to 1995, 1997, and you have like Office 97. You know, you had Excel. You had Microsoft Access, these tools that have been sitting on everybody's computer for now, what, 30 years? And many people don't know how to use Excel still, right? Like some people who are highly intelligent wouldn't necessarily know how to do a sum formula in Excel or how to use a pivot table, let alone how to design a relational database. So there's definitely these barriers between, I'm not saying that Excel and Microsoft Access are the same as AI, but there's always a barrier between this sort of a technology and using it in a company, even if it's something like a productivity application like that. And then the really interesting thing about AI for me is that if you are able to leverage AI to change the human-computer interaction paradigm and move it forward, maybe it makes that technology that's there, which is AI in itself, maybe you can get more leverage out of it with less effort in a way, right? Because it's different to understanding functions in Excel or creating, you know, like a relational database, because it's not only giving you the technology, but it's also changing the human-computer interaction paradigm. Yeah. I think that's really fascinating. And then if you're able to connect the dots on that, maybe it will go a lot faster than, you know, people learning to use Excel.
Even. Yeah. Well, but in reality, it's so big the way you describe it, like deeply transformational at the core of how you're organized and how you think about how you're, let's say if you do systems design, also organizational modeling, if you think systems principles first, you will start with AI as a corner piece technology on how you're going to organize the rest of your,
for sure,
let's say, processes, the human interaction around it, and so forth. So 2 weeks ago, we were in Asia, and Jauk, our founder CEO, did a keynote.
Yep.
And on that keynote, there's one slide that to me really stands out and connects to this conversation, by the way. On the left, you have basically being a bit of AI augmented, where you take existing processes, existing applications, existing experiences, and you AI-ify a little part of that particular journey, or you add a little part of the value proposition and indeed embeds AI capabilities. To us, that really feels like the old days where you're bringing new point solutions to the table to fix a new use case.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, you just have a range of point solutions that they really don't mix and match together. So you get just new legacy with the AI sticker on top of it.
Yeah.
The right part of that slide explained what happens if you go AI native across the full stack and the full organization. I looked at the audience. I mean, the phones were up, people were taking photos because clearly it resonates. But at the same time, I also felt in the feedback like, whoa, this is the first time it's explained this clearly, like just visually.
Yeah.
But also there's a lot of work to do. And where do you start?
Yeah.
And what needs to hold true to make progress step by step? Because of course, you're telling the audience here, like, think in decades, act in quarters.
Yeah.
Okay, but what needs to hold true? What do we need to have in place?
Yeah.
So maybe we can explore that as the second part here.
Yep.
What would you say needs to be in place to really get AI amplification done and to move to an AI native operating model step by step?
Yeah, interesting. So if you think about the human computer interaction side of it as one thing, I think we need to really understand our users better, which is it maybe sounds like a cliche, but imagine if you really understand what the user is intending to do, then you're probably able to leverage AI in new ways to really help them, right? And if you kind of are at the level of saying, okay, like we have these screens, this is the screen, but if you don't really, if you haven't elevated your thinking to understand, okay, the user wants to, I don't know, do a peer-to-peer money transfer to their mom or something like that, that you've got this opportunity with AI to really understand the user better is one thing that I think is quite interesting. And because then you can imagine like how that human-computer interaction could work in the AI age, which is a bit of a slippery slope in a way, because you also don't want to go all the way into full-blown, you know, like just WhatsApp banking or something, like with just full-blown chat. But there is something in the middle, right, where you could reason that having this world of screens and the user acting as the controller, clicking the buttons, is not going to work in the AI world, right? So that's one.
Yep.
That's one layer. Is like, what does this mean for us actually helping users achieve the things that they want to achieve with our services? And then internally in the bank, I think if you think about a topic like data management, maybe it's been okay historically to have batch processes and, you know, to treat it as a kind of compliance topic, right? So if you have BCBS 239. These standards about aggregation of risk data, right? Which is great, and that you have to have that in a bank, right? You have to know how you're making, if you've got credit risk models that you're using, right? You have to satisfy the regulator. That's for sure, right? And I'm not saying necessarily deploy AI immediately for credit risk scenarios, but you can't have like a compliance driven approach to data management and then necessarily get the leverage out of AI. So you also have to raise the bar there. So the first thing is like, what does it mean for users? And then what does it mean for your data management processes? So, you know, you probably have to go from batch to real time data. So you probably have to think more about event streaming and things like that. I think data quality, like as I was alluding to, has to go from a compliance requirement into an AI enabler, right? What does that mean? Who's going to tell you how to do that? I don't know. Maybe it starts from reasoning from the customer, right? And working backwards to what then you need in your data management. And things like, you know, data lineage. So knowing, you know, the, where did the data come from and the, all of the metadata associated with the data. These things also have high leverage in the AI world. So I think some of the topics that have been almost regulatory topics become growth enablers, right? So this whole data management topic is one of them. I think another one is risk management. So of course, you know, if you've worked in a company with a banking license, you quickly realize that in a way, risk management is the central topic. You take a risk, you get a reward, and it has to be explicitly managed in a banking context. So, you know, like if you have the three lines of defense model, so you have the first line who own and manage the risk, the second line who are setting the policies and overseeing, the third line who's group audit, and then you have regulators, right, looking at the first line. How are you going to speed this whole loop up so that you can leverage AI in the first line? So how are you going to connect? How are you going to connect these interests in a way that you're able to innovate and not be like Blockbuster or not be like Nokia, right? So how are you going to innovate but within your risk appetite? So evolving, so maybe a bit of an unexpected answer, but evolving your risk management processes to reflect the AI age, and how are you going to like embed risk management in the same teams that are working on these AI use cases and solutions to speed it up? Because it's not fast enough if it takes, you know, 6 months for someone in the first line to get approval to do something, and you need to be able to iterate, right? So I think those are the three things that come up for me. Reason from the customer back, think about your data management processes, think about your risk management, and how to make an AI version of those things.
In a way, that also means that the regulator needs to be at the table. Because in other conversations that I'm holding with CEOs of banks, also private and wealth managers, they clearly signal we're probably the last industry to move fast because we're the most heavily regulated industry.
Yeah.
Right? So we're innovating at the pace of the regulator. And in some institutions or in some contexts, the regulator is very bullish on AI and embracing the opportunity there.
Yeah.
Specifically in the Middle East as an example. But if you think about the European context, that is absolutely not the case.
Yeah.
If anything, it's a bit more restrictive, a bit more on the safe, conservative side, which also has a competitive impact, I would imagine, over time.
Yeah.
But what would be your initial response to, okay, cool, I'm going to upgrade my risk management appetite internally. We're going to go on that AI transformation step by step.
Yeah.
But you do need the regulator to be part of this conversation in a way, no?
Well, yeah. So I think... yes and no. In a way, you need to be able to show how you have your risk management in order, which means basically that your risk profile is within your risk appetite. So there's going to be some kind of inherent risk with doing something, and then you can mitigate that risk to bring it down within your risk appetite. And this is a challenge that has to be explicit. So for a start, I think certain use cases are higher risk or lower risk. So if you've got a use case, say like our CLO product.
Customer Lifetime Orchestrator.
Yes. So this is about increasing product holdings in the bank. That is relatively low risk compared to, say, using AI to do credit risk decisions.
Yeah.
So there's also this principle of proportionality where so if you would go after more of a, like, let's say a marketing growth use case with AI, even within the banking sector, then that falls in a different category completely to doing credit risk. So it's also a matter of this is what I mean, is that in a way, the decisions that the first line will make about which use cases or business processes they want to go after, they need to be done through this risk lens as well, but in an efficient and effective way. So you can say, okay, we agree these use cases are high value and relatively low risk, so we're going to go after them. Here are the inherent risks. Here are the mitigation strategies. Here's how we plug this into our existing risk management framework in the bank, so everybody's happy. Because then you can show, then you can show in the first line that you're in control, because you have a control framework that is, for example, dealing with probabilistic workloads. And what I mean by that is that, like, so if you have deterministic solutions where you always get the same output every time you put the input in, and then you've got a control because you had QAs who verified that that's the case with, you know, whatever the test strategy is. Now you introduce a probabilistic solution as part of the broader, you know, use case you're going after. You have to then have controls that are going to then work, right? So that you process the output of the LLM in a certain way and map it, and then it has to be above this confidence, or you control the temperature or whatever it is. And that's what I mean, that you have to have this understanding end to end. Otherwise, people are going to be totally out of context in one of these links. So,
yeah,
use case based is one lever, I think. So don't start with the highest risk processing. Maybe, you know, start with things that are high frequency, relatively low risk, or business opportunities, like the CLO example. And get the same understanding about how you then apply controls to an LLM. And then you have to understand the language of the regulator and the interests of the regulator, the third line, second line, to be in the first line and to use AI, I think. But we're doing a really good job of that over here. I think we're thinking a lot about explainable AI. We're thinking, we're targeting use cases that are within, like, let's say a sensible starting point.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's the way I think about it.
If I go back to an episode I recorded probably more than a year ago with Chris Sheon, our product leader on the Customer Lifetime Orchestrator,
mm-hmm.
he basically made the statement, hey, AI is actually not very new in banking. It's been around for decades. There's just multiple flavors of AI.
Yeah.
And whether it's machine learning or predictive analytics or, you know, basically there's a whole domain that's already been around for many, many years. In AML, in KYC, in IDV,
sure.
Like all these concepts are not per se new. What is now new is it is democratized.
Yeah.
It is exponentially, let's say, going this fast that the capabilities are becoming just superior compared to what we had in the past. The compute, the cost is going down. So basically you're going to see a tipping point where it makes no sense to go for the old school traditional way of building these capabilities. So to me, that also signals that it's not the first time that we bring these types of technologies to the table in the context of a bank, right? So also the frameworks, the way you basically do your compliance, your risk management, it's not completely new.
No, I think that these existing processes for risk management, for example, can easily adapt and adopt this, and they have, to your point.
Yeah.
But it's a matter of, for me at least, how do you speed it up so that you get everybody... you get the right team of people together that are able to reason about the business opportunity, the technical solution, the risk management, the data management infrastructure that you take, the customer experience.
You need to bring those people together.
Yeah, bring them together, and then it's then you'll have everybody speaking the same language. I mean, it's not rocket science, right? This stuff to do with risk management, but it's critical and it needs to be explicit.
Yeah,
yeah.
If you actually deploy these use cases. And let's imagine if your first few workflows live, they are deeply embedding AI capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say the deployment, the monitoring, what does that look like compared to the traditional applications that you also monitor in a shape or form?
Yeah, I would say it's a natural kind of evolution, but I do think that you need to be able to connect these things that you're putting into production back to business goals. So, you know, if you have a hypothesis, which is that you're going to increase product holdings by X percent, then is that really happening? So that's like the business level monitoring. And I think you also have to think about your testing strategy as well. Like before you would even put any of this stuff live, how exactly are you going to verify that it does what it's supposed to do, that it still does what it does, what it should do after you make changes? These are all the same principles, basically, as if it was deterministic. So I don't see a lot of difference there. I mean, of course, there's some aspects that come with having an LLM in production that are different. But I think that the cloud providers are sort of are stepping up their game. I do think in the banking industry, there's, of course, well, you're going to have to be able to explain every decision, for example, that was made, depending on the use case that will be either relatively easy or, you know, quite involved. So again, it's proportional to the use case that you're starting with, I would say. But I don't think it's a scary thing. It's more a matter of making it a topic, starting with the right approach, and then keeping everybody fully aligned on what's going on and making sure it's connected back to the business goals in the first place.
Yeah. Now there's this other part of this whole dialogue, and that's about people. And that's about CEOs of large-scale companies making a statement, anyone we recruit from here needs to be AI native,
yeah,
or AI fluent. In a way, it's making a very big statement on it's a talent thing as well, mm-hmm. or it's a people thing, it's a mindset thing.
Yeah.
What's your perspective on this?
Well, it reminds me a lot of, you know, something I was erasing earlier. You used to see in position descriptions, it would say... that they were looking for people that had competency with the Microsoft Office suite. Do you remember this?
I do, yeah.
Sure, familiarity with Microsoft Word and Excel. So
yeah.
It's good. I think it will become like that. Like you would not, I don't think now in 2025, you would see a job description that would say that you have to be proficient with Microsoft Word, right?
You'd be surprised, by the way.
Yeah, but
it's still out there.
Yeah. But I think it will become so embedded that these tools will be really common. I mean, I don't even think now that when I'm using, I mean, I, of course, you know, think about how I'm using it and make sure I'm, you know, not leaking data or something. But my point is, like, it's heavily integrated into my daily workflow now. You probably have the same.
Similar, but we're already a few clicks ahead in time and we're in the bubble.
Like yeah.
We're in the bubble of getting really close to the way yeah. these new capabilities work. But if you think about the larger society, the way also we at Backblaze attract talent or
yeah.
anyone in the tech scene. To me, it's not a demand as much for, are you familiar with the tooling? Because anyone can fire up a ChatGPT instance
yeah.
and just, you know, have a bit of a back and forth. That still is not transformational.
No.
If you use it like that, right? So I think that's maybe the call out.
Yeah.
Would you agree that it's there's like a different breed of talent?
Sure. It depends on which skill set we're talking about. If you're thinking about software engineers, for example, yeah. I mean, I would not... discount, let's say, methodologies like some of the ones we're experimenting over here, like it's called BMAD, you know, where you're able to have a collection of different agents that are helping you with different parts of the process, right? All the way from prototyping things and product managers, you know, maybe starting with building a prototype to get their a rich understanding of what it is that they want to build, and then still creating a document that describes the requirements for the product. But then all the way through the whole life cycle of, let's say, building a product for sure. I mean, then in terms of doing the solution design, I mean, like I, for example, use Claude heavily if I'm thinking about trade-offs of designing a system, all the way through to then implementing it, testing it, I mean, you have to have very smart strategies along the way to stop it going out of context and just making a huge mess.
Which it does.
And then you need to figure out, okay, how are we going to like structure the system so that the blast ratings that is constrained, or my testing approach, or, you know, telling it to work in tiny steps. And so I think that, I mean, yeah, to get to your question, yes, it's radically affecting the way people need to reason about doing their work already. I think for things like software engineering and the whole SDLC, it's already here as a radical change. It's affecting the job market. And I think it will affect other people in other roles, but I also think that companies will embed it in their products so that it maybe is a bit invisible as well. And then you're back to this sort of this more, you know, like if you're using Salesforce to do your job, right, then there will be capabilities in there that are maybe even invisible. To you, which is that human computer interaction point a little bit, that I think the technology will also be able to be used without it being the same as becoming a master in Microsoft Excel, something like that.
Yeah. Maybe final question to ask you before we wrap up. Thinking about 2026, would you be able to have a little bit of a prediction on what you feel is the next big wave when it comes to this whole AI transformation?
Yeah, I think that there's probably a lot of POCs and, you know, consulting activities that will have happened that maybe haven't succeeded. I think there's a statistic, right, that, what is it, 85-90% of them are failing.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a bit of a mega trend. And then it will become more about, okay, but how do we really then succeed with this? And then it'll be looking at some of the more boring aspects that you need to have to be successful. So business process management, data management, risk management, all these kinds of things will start coming to the forefront. And then you will see it more embedded in the company rather than it being a consulting activity on top of, you know, as this sort of POC. I think there'll probably also be quite a bit of technical debt created through, you know, vibe coding, because it's very easy to make an enormous mess, you know, and no company that I've ever worked at has had the problem of not having enough code, but usually had way too much code. So the question is, you know, are the people that are making use of AI now to build software, are they doing it the right way? Probably not. So there's going to be also a lot of cleaning up. And then I think you're going to see a lot of investments in some of the things we were talking about. So data management, for example, like how do you go from it being a compliance topic into it being an AI enabler? And then probably some really targeted use cases and also the user interface evolving. I mean, I'm a big believer in some of the work we're doing over here, exploring what conversational banking looks like and how to really have a hybrid mode where you're able to help users achieve what they want to achieve by understanding their intent. I think that's going to be a big thing, this sort of intent-based human-computer interaction. I think that's a big, that's going to be a big one.
Yeah. We'll connect on this in another 3 to 6 months. We'll do another pulse check. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your insight and your learning so far. Everyone, thanks for listening. If you want to learn more, feel free to follow Adrian on LinkedIn. That's Adrian McPhee. He regularly posts quite some interesting stuff, so definitely follow him. Having said that, see you all next week. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Banking Reinvented, a podcast by Backbase. Make sure to follow us on LinkedIn, where we'll be sharing key insights about our journey towards modernizing banking.